I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Raf from Bristol, and you're listening to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, do you think that in this time of where so much is going on in the world and it's all at our fingertips, that maybe our lack of activism is due to the fact that despair takes less energy than hope? Okay, here comes the show, and remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything. It's a podcast where myself, comedian and writer, and occasional actor Dame Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer.
Hello!
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked, and we are talking everything from...
We are talking everything from Raf from Bristol's question. Do you think the lack of activism in the world is because despair is easier than hope? Dane, I mean, it's not the most, I wouldn't say it's the most cheerful start, but maybe that says something about the question or me.
No. It's an interesting question. I'm not sure if I can answer that succinctly, but what I'd say to Raf is that... the hope that comes from despair normally leads to activism.
Now that is a fucking killer answer that fits perfectly into this section of the show without turning into a 15-minute bit about what is obviously a very good question, Raf. But no, that's a brilliant answer and a brilliant question. And suffice to say, on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dave?
Absolutely. No question is too big, too small, too highbrow, too lowbrow. And if you do enjoy hearing the questions and you do like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify and you'll never miss an episode. Or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's largest podcast network, where you can see all of the special questions from our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show, our guest is a comedian and writer. He is the creator and host of the Care Home Tour and the Addiction Clinic. He has also sold out shows at Edinburgh Fringe Festival, Brighton Fringe, Vault Festival, and Leicester Comedy Festival, to mention a few. His debut book, I'll Die After Bingo, a funny memoir about elderly care, drug abuse, and comedy, will be released by Penguin Ebury in 2022. Please welcome to the show, Pope Lonergan.
Hello! Hello!
Hi, Pope.
So, how Pope. Doing?
Yeah, hello.
I should also include one of the coolest names in comedy, as well as my own. Pope Lonergan. This is not the main question, but like, talk me through souvenir shops at theme parks, Pope. How many times? How many times? Like, you'd be like, oh, not this time. And then the one time at school that we're going to the Vatican City, you're like, yeah.
Yeah, it's do you know what? I need to come up with an origin story for the name, right? Because I actually don't, it's a name, it's not an actual name. It is, my dad was a Catholic, but he's a Catholic, but he didn't actually give me that name. But I've got no cool reason for choosing that name. It's literally like a placeholder name that then Richard Gadd said, just use that name. And then I went, oh, right, I'll just use that name then. I was sorted. And then just started going, there's no Pope Lonergan. There's nothing to it. It was, you know, like Beck, when he sung the song Loser, he said he just went to a recording studio, sung a bunch of nonsense, had the tune or whatever, and then the nonsense became the thing itself. That became the song. Just the same with the name. But I definitely need to find a better story than that.
I think you should change it. I think you should do it like the Joker does it. So every time somebody asks, you just tell a different version of the same sinister story. So you could be like, my father was a Catholic, dedicated to him. He couldn't get enough of confession one night.
I like the idea of like sort of self-mythologizing anyway and kind of working with it and tweaking it. And Aphex Twin, like Richard D. James, he's got the same birthday as me, and he's someone I kind of really love, it just really fascinating person. And he's all done that for years. He's always had that played tricks on journalists about everything, about every aspect of his life. So it's so slippery now, the truth and untruth of Aphex Twin, that no one really knows anything about him.
If he ran for president, I would still feel more confident than America's last president. That's what's so crazy about it, is that despite how all these stories meander and mislead, I'm still like, I'm more inclined to believe that guy is a genuine guy. That's the state of the world right now. That's the state of the world.
Yeah, right now. It is.
Quite nice for a celebrity or a person in the public eye to be undefined, to be mysterious. That's a good commodity. People seem so desperate to tell people every detail of their fucking life. And it's like, no. Like, I don't want you to know. Like, that's kind of
hold a bit back. Yeah. I mean, problem is, I'm very much of my generation. I am a pathological discloser. But it's kind of something I've got. It's kind of something I've got from my mum. Like, she's like an unapologetically bolshy Essex mum. And kind of, there's no boundaries. Just always like, tell mummy everything. Tell mummy everything. She's going to the shop telling the lady who do her nails about my my years of drug addiction. Apropos of nothing. Like, they never... And so whenever she goes in there, they always go, how is your drug son? That is how they first.
And you think she, the thing, even then you think she'd go, he's doing fine, but she goes, well. normally mums go, he's taking it a day at a time, but she's like, well, actually, this week.
It's always that scenario there where you're like, I kind of don't want to be, I've some context about who your mum is, Poe, because we've worked on something in the past involved your mum. And, I kind of like that person that tells you more information than they need to tell you. But the only problem is if they're telling you it at a time when you don't have the time to fucking hear it. So it could be like...
Yeah.
That awkward scenario where you you think you'll make conversation with someone in a shop, right? Just because you want to be nice to the person who's being giving you the thing that you're buying. And then within you're like 5 minutes later and you're like, fuck, I've really made a fucking mistake. I shouldn't have asked them how they are. Do you know what I mean? It's just a bit of an error.
I think that you should have tills like that. Tills, you know, the tills that have like 10 items or less, they should also be for like 10 words or less. So you have to keep it small talk. So if people are in the Q&A, they're like, well, madam, there are only so many. It's just, how are you? How's the family? And how's the weather in this line? If you want to start gas bagging, you'll have to go all the way down to the end with all the other lonelies.
Well, you know what? That perfect time to say it's probably time for a question, isn't it, Dane, as the format of this show dictates?
Absolutely. And Pope, as our very esteemed guest, we welcome you to the show and we welcome you to ask our first question, which can be any question you'd like, which we like to discuss for about 50 minutes or some change. Then Howard, as my co-host, will then ask another question, which we'll also discuss. Then lather, rinse, repeat. I will do the same. And we can discuss that question for about 50 minutes or so. And then we'd like to leave a little window for you to let our good listeners find out where they can find out more about your good works. How does that sound?
Perfect. Perfect.
Lovely. Well, the floor is yours, sir.
Okay, I'll just a little bit of context for this. So it's me and my mum had this discussion. So I it's a bit of a nasty joke, but I'll put it out there anyway. We were talking about there's these babies that have got something called anencephaly, and it means they haven't got a brain. They're basically born without a brain, or they just have a brain stem. So they have the same sort of cognition as, and this is really offensive to say this, but it's sort of a truth to it. They basically got the same cognition as a worm, which is like a bundle, because the worm's just got like a bundle of nerve cells, like a ganglion. Anyway, so I made a joke to my mum, a kind of shock factor joke, to purposely like get going, oh, don't say things like that. And I said, oh, it's fine. If you're going to punch down and mock the weak, so to speak, like really go for it and just like have a go at anencephalitic babies. I said, because the dead after a day part of anencephaly means they struggle to form actionable pressure groups anyway. So they're not gonna, there's no backlash against that. You have a go at a brainless baby, you're done with, right? Then me and Nick launched into It's fine. But anyway, so then that actually turned into quite an interesting, thoughtful discussion about the idea of personhood and at what point does a person become a person, or what is like kind of the starting point of sentience? When does a person become a person? Wow. Because there's actually legal wrangling with regards to anencephalitic babies about that they're not legally persons.
We've never talked about that on this podcast, have we, Dane? When does life begin is a big debate.
It depends what we're defining as life versus sentient life, aren't we? Because is it the idea of having a consciousness? Because that's obviously what distinguishes, anencephalitic child?
Anencephaly.
So, I mean, that they can still perform life processes that just don't have any cognitive function, right? Or like a worm, you know, so that, I mean, a worm is still alive, right? So, but what we're defining as a person. The thing is, I feel like person seems to be more of a legal definition than anything else rather than a biological one, because I guess a large part of justification for atrocities, particularly in America, for example, are based on the fact that they wouldn't classify the chattel slaves as people and refer to them as free fits of a human being in order to legitimize their actions towards their slaves. So I guess the definition of a person is largely based on, it's more of a legal definition than anything else.
It's a very challenging conversation, right? Because ultimately, the bit that I always think about it is the kind of definition of happiness and kind of like feeling, right? Feeling is what kind of comes into this, right? We look at people's existence as, you know, this kind of life of feeling things, and you know, there are stages of the, you know, pregnancy or, you know, kind of procreation where, you know, most people would claim that this is not a sentient being. But obviously, once you start getting God involved, as the right wing of Christianity in America tends to, that's their job, isn't it, really? That's kind of all they're well into that, aren't they? It becomes a bit difficult. It becomes a bit difficult to try and, you know...
Well, I think it's back down to the legal definition again, because the same people will use the definition of a person and the inherent rights or observations you have to make when dealing with a person within the legal system varies depending on who's making the laws. Because the same people who would say that they're pro-life are the same people a lot of time in states that also support a death penalty, which in itself is a paradox. Yeah. So, I mean, I would say maybe the semantics of it would be the definition of a person would be when that person imprints and encounters other people.
What do you think, Pope? You're the poser of the question. Where do you take it?
So I think that Dane, you make an excellent point about the idea of personhood is more like a legal concept, and how do you define a legal entity? And it goes into the Americans. I don't know why the abortion debate has kind of really caught fire over in America, but it's never really been like a kind of a tent pole, a rhetorical tent pole within rhetoric over in the UK or England, maybe in Ireland, but not so much in England. There's a point, like, as a baby, like, there's a point where you're basically just like a yogurt. Like, there's a point where you're basically just like a schmutz. You're just like a yogurt. You're just a yogurt that can blink. And there is a point in that. But then I think you make a good point in you have like the material self, and then you have the social self, then you have the spiritual self. The social self is obviously how your life and your mind intersects with other people. But then the reason I talk about it is, having worked in elderly care for 9.5 years and worked with people who have, you know, the neurodegenerative diseases and stuff, which, you know, can impact different parts of the brains, there's you're constantly negotiating a kind of a you're constantly negotiating kind of these ethical dilemmas,
yeah,
and trying to, you know, kind of change the goalposts of like between in what is like normal interaction, what is even like ideas like what is consent and all this kind of stuff. It's such a murky thing. I've written about it kind of at length, and I don't think there is a definitive thing. I think that's the problem.
This is the thing that, you know, whether it's we're talking about humanity or personage or like, well, quantum theory, there is no theory of, we're still trying to find the theory of relativity, basically. Even when it comes to human consciousness, because you know, some people would refer to maybe certain emotions and certain instincts may take precedence over certain cognitive functions. But then, you know, when we talk about being guided primarily by your instincts, then that's referred to having a lizard brain where the drive is only for self-gratification. Because if you take that state of what's referred to as a lizard brain, most children, as you said, because they don't have the cognitive function to do so, are not conscious of other beings. That's why children don't give a shit if you're tired, they're hungry, go fuck yourself, I want to be fed. Whereas, and that's only rightfully so, and that's not because, and even though, you know, if, and if you were to attribute that, if you were to see that same behavioral trait in a human being, they would be described as maybe selfish or arrogant or boorish if someone's like, I don't give a shit, I'm hungry. Like, so, like, for example, if you're a guy and you say that to your wife, then you'd be a misogynist and a chauvinist. But if you're a one-year-old, everyone's like, well, he's just hungry. Even though you're displaying the same absence of, I guess, consideration for someone else's feelings.
I've got an instance with my kid. This, you know, I've told the listeners many times about the bloke that lives here now. He's nearly 14 months old, right? Which sounds a lot when you say it, but you realise that's not, obviously. And he, you know, he's got this thing now. When I open the door, we go for a walk, and I come back and open the door, you know, I take the keys out, open the door, and he just wants the keys, right? He just wants my keys, and he realizes they open the door, but he doesn't quite understand how they open the door. And then he takes the keys from the front door to the back door and pisses around with them there, and then comes back to the front door and pisses around. And he would do this repeatedly for about half an hour. Now, if you gave me anyone, Dane, any of you who did this in my life, I would be like, mate, you are so fucking annoying. Like, this is the stupidest thing. The keys don't, you're not even putting it in the lock. You're just banging it against the door. You're an idiot. And yet, what he's showing me is this incredible progress that he understands that something, you know, almost like a magic trick, like something opens the door. It's remarkable to him. And that progress, which, you know, let's say that's happened in the last 2 or 3 months, because he started walking, he's starting, you know, all this. But there was a period of time before this, the first 6 months, he is just a blob who does nothing.
Yeah.
He is just a useless, you know, I disliked him, but there wasn't that much to like about him.
He was a yogurt.
He was a yogurt.
Yeah. But this is so fascinating. It's apparently, so kids, it's up until the age of talking about like normal developmental standards. It's up until the age of 4 that basically, under about 3 years old and under, they see the rest of the world as like a prosthesis, as like an extension of themselves. They don't understand that there's experiential like division. They don't understand that. And so like a guy I care for who's actually a year older than me, but because of he had severe meningitis, he's had a sort of a arrested development. So he's got this kind of cognitive function of somebody who's a lot younger. And he, yesterday, like, he likes, my whole job is to kind of facilitate a controlled rampage to kind of wear him out and for us to be a bit boisterous and like go up and down, like go up and down slopes and go a bit mad in his wheelchair and all that kind of stuff. But so he likes anything that's a bit kind of antic or like a minor spectacle. But occasionally he'll do his thing where he'll like get a stick or something, he'll whack himself in the head and he'll go, ow, like that. And then he'll go to me, why aren't you ow? Why aren't you ow? Like, why aren't you owing? Because he can't understand that I'm not feeling it differently to him, or he's feeling it differently to me. He thinks of like, well, I felt that, and you're part of this as well.
That is so. You must really know it. Yeah. That's fucking fascinating. But you know, to me, there's maybe there's something more profound about that. Like, and I just want to say, yeah, these theories are all musings from a fucking comedian for anybody listening. But here goes. But it's kind of like, obviously, you said there are aspects of his cognitive functions which have been diminished through meningitis. And so, you know, when they say, like, if you lose one of your five senses, the other ones become more attuned. So in this instance, like, it could be that he's maybe some emotional centers within his brain have become heightened. He's reading functions within your face, maybe how you react to things, like you said, being a bit boisterous, meeting him at these emotional levels, because other parts of cognitive function, he's not able to communicate in that fashion. So by him hitting himself and saying, ow, because he is aware of a more empathetic link in terms of how you guys communicate with each other, that's probably why he's like, how come you don't ow as well? Because... So in a sense that, like, when you look at how other people act out on, like, social media, for example, a lot of time people will engage in these kind of displays, or even people who engage in maybe self-harm. I think they're all facets of the same instinctual need for human beings to imprint on each other.
It's because, like, the automatic, when he's doing something and expecting me to experience the same thing as he's experiencing, the conclusion we might draw from that is, oh, he's, you know, he's got a kind of limited cognition. He's quite myopic. He's only head. He doesn't have that. But it's actually the complete opposite of that.
It could be he completely understands. That the center of his emotional intelligence, because I think there's I think his name is Gardner, but it's like these types of intelligence, including like spatial, kinesthetic, and like emotional intelligence. Where he's lost the other functions, this has become more heightened. So he's like, so in the same way that he's saying, it's like when comedians go on stage, you go, I've recently become single. And if the crowd doesn't respond, they go, hello. And everyone goes, then they go, thank you. So it could be the very same cognitive function, just that, you know, he lacks the same tools to kind of articulate. So I guess kind of trying to dovetail the whole thing, when it comes to like, what we consider to be people. I think that's more of for me, that's the same function as, like, you know, human beings having the same semantic discussions or existential discussion. It's an existential discussion about human beings in terms of existentialism versus society and legality. Where a person begins is not, I don't think it's the same narrative as when life begins. So even if a child has no cognitive function, is essentially a worm, you know, we respect life. It would be seen to even be distasteful if someone just went around killing worms wholesale just for the sake of it. So,
I save worms. I like, may see a worm knocking about, I'll save it and put it in a safe space. I've never killed anything, not even flies. Don't even kill flies, you know, on purpose. I'm kind of really strict with that. And I think it's just, I mean, I always say, like, I'm an etherealist rather than a materialist, because it's mainly because I realise there's limitations in the sort of science and in the way that science can make make sense of the world. But then there's, you know, there's people who have a lot more advanced understanding of scientific theory and that, who will say, like, just because we don't quite know, it doesn't mean it's not there. There will be a method of understanding of this and working out in an empirical way. We just haven't reached it yet. And I think there's stuff that will always be beyond our understanding, but I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe one day, Pope. Maybe one day, hey, mate. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
But what a great question, no, Dane. Hey, that's
really,
a beauty.
Really, really good. Really good.
Well done. Well done, Pope. You nailed it, mate.
I just want to apologise to all the anencephalitic babies out there who are listening. It was a crass, crude kind of entry point into that conversation. I do apologise. You have worth, and you're not worms. I love you all.
Worms have worth too. And anybody who was offended by that, have a think if every child with cognitive function is being fed in your country. And until they are, don't worry about what the fuck Pope is saying. So
good start to the show. The question I've got is probably going to be in a slightly different tangent, if that's okay, Pope. You up for that?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank.
LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Because my question is actually partly inspired, but we had Nick Helm on a little while ago. He kind of asked an interesting question. And my question is probably quite similar, which is, what the fuck is wrong with people? What the fuck is wrong with people, mate? Because I tell you what, Pope, right? I'm going to do my bit. And then you guys, listen, you just have a thing. Tell me what you want to moan about. Who you don't have to name any names, just... give someone you've fucked. Honestly, I've got a house that I live in with my wife and child. The child makes mess. So you know what happens? I need someone to clean it. Even if I was good at cleaning, I don't really have the time. So I want to pay for a cleaner, right? As listeners who stick with the show will know, I asked a cleaner around. She was awful. I didn't continue to keep her services, right? I then get another cleaner. He turns out to be pretty fucking good, right? And unfortunately, there's been a family problem, illness, and she can't work here anymore. So I had to go back looking again. Obviously, I'm very sorry for that person, you know. Anyway, the reason I'm bringing this up is because I couldn't believe what happened the other day, right? I found two numbers of two cleaners who could come around. Dane's face is like, I'm waiting, you know, because he knows I haven't told him this yet, but I've been waiting to tell him.
I've been waiting to hear this.
Two cleaners in 2 days. Come around and check out the house, and then obviously one of you is going to come and clean my house, right? The first one turns up, right? She looks at me, and she goes, okay, how are you here to clean up? Yeah, she walks around and literally walks into the house, and the first thing she says to me is, oh, it's a bit dirty, isn't it? I was like, what the fuck do you think you're here for? What the fuck am I... What? Like, well, yes. That's the point of this conversation. You're here to help me clean the house. So she walks around. I kind of... And listen, guys, people at home, you don't know me. I'm nice. I'm really nice. I go above and beyond. Maybe that's too much and that's what puts people off me times. But I try to be nice. I talk to people at checkouts. I'm nice. I show her around. She's like, okay, sure. Well, this is my rate and blah, blah, blah. She leaves. I sit down at my desk. I'm just about to text Tara and my wife and go, I don't think I found the right cleaner. The cleaner texts me to say that she's had a think about it and that she doesn't want to clean my house. No. She doesn't want to clean my house. What does it look like we're doing here? What are we doing here? I'm not smearing shit on the floor, am I? It's just a few crumbs.
Oh, my God.
And the next one turns up. This gets worse. The next one turns up the next day, right? And instantly I'm like, well, this person's just so on the back foot. It's like, I'm like so desperate. Please make this work. Like, please make this work. Turns up and there's just you know when someone's just like, I'm a bit uncomfortable here, like, and that's fine, but I'm like, look, I just, you know, please come. So she's like, okay, you know what? I think this is a lot of work, but I'm happy to try and do it. I was like, oh, cool. Like, okay, so maybe you need to, you know, in like 3 or 4 weeks of cleaning, maybe we'll get it up to the standard that you expect, lovely lady. She turns up a couple of days later, does the cleaning, and it looks lovely, right? Perfect, right? So I'm thinking, well, sweet, we're all right here. And then, you know, comes to the end, she's like, okay, payment. I was like, here you go. And I say to her, so, and it's been a while since I've dated Pope, but I don't forget anything that goes on when you date, right? I say to her, so yeah, great. So it'd be lovely to see you next week. And she literally looks at me and goes, Yeah. And then just walks out. Doesn't even engage for a second. Just does the ultimate. Like, I know when a woman's rejected me, it happened many, many times. And she just walks straight out, and we've never heard from her again.
Oh, my God.
So if anyone knows a fucking good cleaner, anyone who knows someone's actually a cleaner who can clean in the Hertfordshire area, please get in contact.
Essentially, Pope, this is Howard's question. Why is it so hard to get good help nowadays to remix?
As I say, listen, what the fuck is wrong with some people? That's the question. What the fuck is wrong with people?
It's so funny because it's like during a time where there's so much job instability and work is drying up left, right and centre, and they still reject you when you're going, here's some work.
I feel like Pope said, there's somewhere in a coffee shop, like on across town, there are three people within the industry being like, what the fuck is wrong with people? Like, I'm a cleaner. I'm not an interior. If you saw this guy's house, I'm a cleaner. I'm not a fucking sanitation technician. Like, there was shit on the wall. Like, Howard, it sounds like it sounds like Dylan is smearing feces on the walls. What the fuck is happening in your home?
I've even gone as far to say to them, this wall where he eats, right? Don't worry about this wall. I made the same joke. I made the same joke three times now, which is we're going to sell this wall if he becomes a famous artist. Right. But you don't need to clean the wall. Clean the house. Like, the bathroom. Like, you know, anyway. So what the fuck is wrong with some people? Pope, what the fuck is... You can talk about anyone you like. Who's wrong?
No, yeah, I mean, including the producer of the show, who apparently lives in squalor, is also fair game.
Lives in the fucking maize prison where they keep the IRA. Yeah.
Which was built on an ancient Indian burial crack house, apparently.
Oh, my spidey senses are tingling for that. Can't go back there. I don't know. Yeah, so like talking on the same thing. Okay, so I like what you were saying at the beginning, I kind of I like to think that I'm, you know, a not necessarily a good person, but someone who has like kind of a moral threshold or like moral intuition, sort of understands right and wrong, understands ethics and stuff. But I can go, you know, we all like to think that we're kind of involved in like social justice and all the kind of good stuff. And we want to go above and beyond to kind of present that image to the world. But then I get the problem is I'm a drug addict and any kind of spark of excitement, I'll like want to like grab it quickly, even though I was a very like hermetic, isolated drug user, but just anything that's like, oh, look, it's going to make the day a bit more exciting. There's going to be a little bit of uplift. I'll kind of grab onto it. So when I was working in the care home, it was a very kind of multicultural workforce, which I really loved, but there was a lot of like kind of ethical friction and that down ethnic lines. And there was always beef between, at my particular home, like the Eastern European workers and then the English workers. But I tried to rise above it, try and rise above the fray. But then I did say I overcompensated. So the remaining workers were talking about the kind of job instability they have. And they haven't got the same job protections as we had as English workers. As like, oh no, this is bullshit. And they're like, yeah, well, you know, we're taking every shift under the sun, and we can barely pay our rent, and we're grafting, we're striving, and it's just not enough. And I was like, oh, look, I'm like, oh, this, I hate this injustice. I am going to right this wrong. I am going to be your salvation. And I sort of started an impromptu flyering company. So I said, oh, look, I'm doing a couple of comedy nights in Southend. I can pay you to flyer if that's the sort of work you want to do. And they were like, oh, yeah, that'd be really great. It'd be really helpful. And I was like, oh, no, great. I can help other people, whatever. But I just did this like off the cuff. I invented a flyering company in that moment without thinking about the monetary need of such a company or the logistics or any of it. But obviously I still wanted to fulfill my promise to these people. So I ended up working extra shifts in the same care home that they're working to finance the flyering company that I started by enlisting the carers from that home. And so, like, literally, like, 90 pounds, I was taking off extra shifts just to fund the flyering company and leaving myself, like, utterly broke. So, yeah.
But how long did that last?
It lasted for about 4 months. Yeah, it lasted about 4 months. Right. 90% of my earnings was going towards propping up, like, a Romanian family that I had.
company.
Yeah. And we all were all on, like, on the same contract. We all worked the same, had the same money and the same hours and stuff. It's like, so, yeah, that's kind of, I think that was the only story. And also, what the fuck is wrong with people? Oh, mate, I get annoyed at loads. I'm very hateful at the moment, especially because of this become exacerbated because of lockdown. I just kind of get annoyed at every, like, people feel like they're too much, there's too much of them on Twitter. Like, if they're trying to affect a kind of online persona or personality, trying to, you know, a cultivated persona online, I think there's so much of you in you. Like, in their Twitter or like, there's so much of them.
It's a tricky one, that, isn't it? Because I find myself in scenarios there where I like people, right? So I do like them. And I therefore don't want to take what, you know. But I had a scenario. Look, if she's listening to this episode of the show, I think she maybe does sometimes. Like, apologies that I'm bringing this. But when I saw her, this was quite rare. When I saw her, I said, oh, hey, how are you? Well, I know you've been eating for the last 3 months because you put it online every day. And obviously that sounded like a burn to everyone, but I was just commenting on the fact that she puts everything up online that she eats, which I don't hate her for it. I just thought it was the obvious comment to make because that's all I know about your last 3 months since I've seen you. So
it's just when you're kind of stuck with it all the time, like we all are with each other within the online realm. I'm just sick of life. I think that's pretty much it.
Good. We got to the point there. Dane, what the fuck is wrong with people,
I think you didn't think this is the case, Howard, but your question is very much linked to Pope's original question. I think what's wrong with people is that they forget that they are people, and a lot of the time people act as if they're only being guided by nothing other than their instincts, and not considering the part of them that makes them a person, which is the consideration of other people. So in terms of social media, Pope, I think that's one of the problems about social media is that because obviously it is the culmination of artificial intelligence and the height of technology, algorithms and the like, is that by having that be the guiding, even though it's people's minds that guide social media, it's a artificial brain that facilitates all of these minds to be able to express themselves on social media. And I say that because if a computer is the brain on social media in the form of the servers and the apps, it means that we don't have to rely on our own, which allows for us to do stuff on the internet, like post articles that piss us off without being able to read the details of them or fall for clickbait. It's because we have outsourced the cognitive function to something else, which is the brain operating social media. Like, we can wade into a conversation or a thread about an event that's taking place that we've not even seen because that's been facilitated by somebody else. So what's wrong with people is that, I guess, the artificial intelligence... There you go. Why am I taking so long to say it? What's wrong with people is that they're allowing an artificial intelligence to replace their intelligence. So,
yeah.
So
what a good observation.
So if people are doing it outside, you're able to say, because that's the thing, you can say stuff without any factual basis. And because the remit is of the artificial intelligence to present these facts to you or display them for you and facilitate you having a conversation with someone who may be a detractor from your narrative, you don't have to do the work yourself anymore.
Well, I think in conclusion, there's a fucking lot wrong with people.
Because they stop acting like people, because, you know, it's like I said, I look at it another way, is that if you've ever seen a crossroads when a traffic light system is not working compared to when it is working, people behave very differently. If you know that if I edge out, irrespective of what these lights say, that I risk being hit by somebody, you'll drive very differently. Whereas if you are a bus driver and you can run a red light and you've got fleet insurance and you know that you're less likely to have your car being damaged, and also you're not personally liable for it, then you drive very differently to someone in the same way that, like, when you're a sole trader and you run a business, you run a business differently, and you may have to apportion a certain level of morals and ethics and business and corporate responsibility, because if you don't, you have what's called unlimited liability for your actions. Whereas if you can hide within a PLC or as a board of directors and you become part of the legal fiction, then you will conduct yourself. So for example, if I run the lemonade stand and the lemonade kills somebody, I know I'm going to be in trouble. Whereas if a bit of benzene goes into a bottle of Perrier water and poisons somebody, it's not the Dame Baptiste company, it's Perrier. So I can hide behind this legal fiction and not act like a person. So the main problem, what the fuck is wrong with people, Howard, is that they're not behaving like people. Right.
Yeah, I think that's it. Just really quick on that. I think that's really fascinating, really great answer, Dane. And I think what you're saying about it's kind of distilling life down to the gamification of like the dopamine re-up, like the dopamine re-up, the reuptake of dopamine, which you get from, you know, like, as we know, these Twitter and stuff like that, they were engineered to kind of play into that addictive cycle. And it is, and then when it becomes all about that dopamine procurrence or reuptake of dopamine or whatever, it is like everything is distilled down to like a worm's cerebral ganglia, which it has like the bundle of nerve cells in his head that acts as a substitute brain, of just that everything just becomes that reward cycle. And like you said, it's stripped away of humanity, of empathy, of everything else that kind of gives life a profundity of meaning. It all just becomes that addictive drive, which, as I know, like, you know, is a really damaging and detrimental to everyone's health. And I think there'll be long-term consequences to this, which we're only...
Sadly for the listeners, we're going to have to move on to the next question. But that was a joyous cavalcade of myriad of interesting elements to what I thought was just me moaning about my cleaner. But it turned into all sorts. So over to Dane for the final question of today's show.
Obviously, Pope, you have extensive experience working with people with various different maybe cognitive function or disabilities, which are sometimes as a function of trauma or genetic predisposition, but also through old age. Now, I feel like one of the most, one of the best epiphanies I've kind of had, one of the most accurate affirmations I've heard in life here is that the creative or the successful artist or creative is a person who's inner child survived. And I say that because I feel like the person, what allows me to function in this world now and enjoy my job and my line of work and what I do for a career, is that I can remember who I was 20 plus years ago. And I'm like still the same person, and the same coping mechanisms and the same drives and aspirations. I'd say the same emotional aspirations are still the same ones I had when I was younger. And I would like to think that I still maintain the same, you know, I suppose, Wunderlust and all the other stuff I have now when I'm in another 30 or 40 years. And I wanted to ask you, from your observation, what can or tends to happen most commonly to the human mind, body, soul, or spirit, depending on how you want to interpret it, with old age? Because I feel like we live in a highly aged society nowadays where people find it hard to even conceptualize that somebody who's 80 years old has dreams, daydreams, has imagination, can fantasize, can role play, can present a heightened version of self, you know, goofs off, has jokes, has fantasies. And I'm wondering if we can challenge that perception or this question.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like my driving mission in life is, other than the usual kind of stuff we do for as a matter of self-interest, I want to enhance my visibility or public profile or whatever, to also give this these questions a platform. And I think it's when you go into these environments, and I think it's a natural reaction, what we're talking about personhood is, you kind of, you go into these environments and see people acting in maybe slightly aberrant ways. And it looks like a, you know, a room full of broken toys or something. It's very, you do have that dehumanizing process. So I just want to say, first of all, if people feel that, like, don't feel guilty for that reaction. Obviously, like, that's an instantaneous reaction, but then you move beyond that. And I've kind of felt like I'm trying to bring it down into like one specific thing so I could talk about like all the different avenues of this question. Whenever I'm at work, I think it's very possible to try and help people, you know, get reacquainted with their ludic selves and their sort of young, like you said, it's something that we have automatically in childhood and that gradually corrodes over time or whatever. I honestly think there should be like a state mandated volunteerism or something where people actually go into care homes or any kind of social care environments and they're kind of, because a lot of it is like is where it's like kind of it becomes marginalia. It's kind of brushed to the margins of society and out of sight, out of mind. And when I go in, it's this person-centered care. So we always try and make sure there's not a uniform institutionalized approach to how to deal with everyone. It's not like everyone's got to get up at this time or eat this food or like it. Even though routine can be important, it's also to understand the person behind the illness. So they're not just that type of dementia. They're also, you know, Vera. And the best way to do that is to don't try and restrict any behaviors, even if there's like behaviors, as long as they're not putting themselves or others in harm's way or putting themselves at risk, but like allow them to present themselves in a kind of variegated, multiform way as any human being would present themselves. So don't if they don't try and make it like, oh, well, it's got to be upbeat all the time, it's got to be upbeat, we're all happy, it's happy and nice, these are your friends, and if one of them's going, I want to die and they ain't my fucking friends, go like, yeah, let's explore that for a moment, Vera, you know. Yeah. I would have that kind of relationship with them where I wouldn't try and make it sanitized, I wouldn't try and make it like sentimental and like everything upbeat all the time. I would just kind of like knock about of them as human beings, right? And like talk to them. Like one bloke told me about the time during the war where his mate melted against the ship, against the side of the battleship because of a bomb was dropped. He saw his mate literally melt like ice cream on the ship. Very traumatic. He told me that it was unsolicited. Like he just came out of that. Very kind of traumatic episode in his life. And for whatever reason, because I was always really good at it, just like fostering an intimate, trusting relationship with these people, because that's all they were. They were the people. And I think also when it comes to, it's particularly hard when it's your family member and say your mum or your dad, and they are a changed version of the mum and the dad that you used to know, and you kind of have to relinquish this idea of what you had of your mum and dad, and so like you might no longer factor into your mum's reality as a son, but they'll see that you're a comforting presence and they kind of know you vaguely, don't try and kind of reinforce your idea of reality that you're experiencing onto them. Kind of allow them to like.
Sorry to cut you again, Pope. In those instances,
that's right.
because again, I think you're really describing what you referred to earlier on, is that as cognitive functions begin to maybe decrease or decline in some people, then yeah, like I said, it maybe comes down to the remnants of synaptic links and ganglion nerve clusters, or and like you said, is there a way, I mean, is there a way people should prepare to understand, or is there an explanation that exists for, like, where it might be a parent who doesn't know who you are, but like you said, sees you as a comforting figure or someone they can confide in? Is that attributed to remnants of memories that have helped to form these cognitive nervous functions, or is it just like, you know, the natural instinct that, like, you are a comforter and a caregiver, and this person's like a child again, and they don't really give a fuck who you are, but you're good to them and you're nice and you satisfy that sort of need of their gratification? And is that how it works? Just because I think it's very useful.
Because there is really only a slightly complex answer, which I know is annoying, but it's person-centered care, right? So it's a bit trial and error. It's a bit trial and error. And because there's lots of different types of dementia, dementia is just like a symptom of a pre-existing illness, and it depends which parts of the brain it attacks and shuts down. So it is just through trial and error, getting to know what works well for different people, understanding the person behind the illness. And like, so if one person, you can see that them being coddled or you being quite tactile is a comfort to them and seems to work, great. If you've got another person who's like, I don't want your cuddling bollocks, like, I don't want this or whatever, then you respect that, and you like, they've set them, demarcated those boundaries and respect that. So, and there is trial and error. It's just trying different things with different people, getting to know them as a human being, and not just as like one uniform illness. And and it can be hard as well, because they may occupy three different timelines simultaneously, like in one moment. So like, at a woman, like, her husband was alive and dead in one moment. Like, she knew he was alive, but you knew he was dead, but he was also alive. And it can be hard to try and navigate your way through that. It's just stay consistent with their version of reality. So whatever they're giving you in that moment, whatever reality they're experiencing, and just stay, rather than providing a corrective, rather than reality reorientation, which is what used to be in kind of vogue in the 80s, where you would say, no, like, your husband's dead, Vera, he's dead, don't be stupid, he's dead, so we're in a care home.
You're just going to cause another trauma anyway, and that can lead to more degenerative issues, or someone will end up you're adding neuroses to that disorder as well.
Exactly. Yeah. It just becomes so disorientating. Like, imagine someone, you know, just coming out and telling you your reality.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's interesting, because there's some people out here, if you tell them they're not funny, they're having a breakdown, you know? So that's a way of looking at it. It's like, it's kind of like, we put it all the way down to, like, obviously these are the diagnosis. This is like versions of dementia and other degenerative issues, but, you know, I'm taking a risk now, Howard, but then you could argue that same dissonance, or that same, or is it, because it's by the same token, is telling somebody your husband's dead, is that like, are you mortality shaming somebody? Because if you said, actually, you're fat, that's fat shaming, right? But, you know, it's also a subjective truth. And then going back to what you said before, your definition of life or death, if someone's husband was like an organ donor and their organ is functioning in someone else's body, are they technically dead?
Yeah, so, well, that's exactly. I think that talks to like the kind of deconstructionist innate slipperiness of reality, which I believe anyway. I don't believe in.
Yeah.
I don't believe in absolute truth or kind of concrete reality, which is maybe why I'm more receptive as a carer to these kinds of ideas of the slipperiness of truth and reality, because I can understand that it for us, not just for people with dementia.
Yeah, of course.
For us,
but if you watch your friend get melted to a ship, you might create a whole new personality that doesn't remember that shit, just so you don't have a nervous breakdown or want to commit suicide from the sorrow. Mm. You might.
Exactly. Who are we to say that's not the right move, eh?
Exactly. I mean, that's what I'm saying, is that there should be a field of study to go over the variance and the range of moves that are available. Like, I think it's very interesting the part you said about this, maybe not community service, but almost, I think, as a scientific field, or like we have social studies. Is there not an interpersonal study as a part of, you know, the human academic curriculum, where you should spend time around an older person and a younger person, or those two people or those two generations should regularly interact to give various perspectives of life or dealing with certain issues of an esoteric nature, because, you know, people need to understand that you know, a consciousness is not something that is tempered or limited by our understanding of linear time.
Yeah. I mean, I think about it, when this story really hits for me is I always think when I'm listening to music, I think it's so interesting, music. It's such a powerful thing. And if you said to me now, is Little Richard dead? Yeah, no, not really.
It's an effective treatment a lot of time with dementia. They play people music and they will appear despondent. But when they hear music from a particular time, they're like, oh, I remember exactly where I was when I heard this.
Well, it's a very powerful thing.
That evocation of emotion is not limited to time. Like, if you remember your parent being abusive when you were 6, if you're 76, you ain't going to forget how that feels, because these don't elicit... Because like Pope said, reality all stems from the secretion of chemicals within your brain. So if that's the case, it means it's no more real then than it was, then it's no more real now than it was then, and vice versa. So, you know, which is a part of why you understand why people, how drugs work and stuff like that as well, is that people aren't chasing the physical gratification, or people aren't considering the gravity of, I don't know, you know, damaging their body, because I'm not chasing something that's physical.
Yeah.
I'm not returning to a state that involves the stimulation of the basic stimulation of, you know, physical things of like my synapses being stimulated by touches and stuff like that. So
yeah. It's an amazing subject, and it has been an amazing episode to cover so much ground. I feel like, Pope, you need to come back on next week and we're just going to do another one, because we're going to do the same questions again and try and work out what we didn't have time to cover in each question, apart from my cleaners, which is fine.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that being said, luckily for ourselves and everyone who's listening, Pope has written a book with effect to all that we've discussed. So, Pope, could you please tell everybody the outlets from which they can find this amazing book?
Yeah, so it's called I'll Die After Bingo, The Elderly and Me, published by Penguin Books, Penguin Ebury, and you can get it. I would recommend pre-ordering it at independent bookstores, but then also, you know, the kind of monoliths like Amazon and just, you know, the more medium scale ones like Waterstones, just wherever you get your books. Pre-order I'll Die After Bingo, and yeah, it's a comic memoir about, like, it's got that stuff to do like comedy in there, like drug addiction, but with, you know, the primary focus being like care homes and elder care. And it's those people said it's like, the people who've read it so far said like it's like loads, like hilarious laugh out loud moments, they said, but you can also be quite very brutal humor in places, but then they said there is also a tenderness of feeling and a delicacy of feeling as well, like it's not all just, you know, really really harsh realities. There is also the intimate relationships I had with these elders, which were, you know, you're right on the threshold of the most profound questions you can imagine in these spaces, which is why, you know, people want to avoid them, which always blows my mind, because you're really tapping into something there in those spaces, which,
well, that's old age is always looking, they were looking, that's staring right at you. You're getting very close to the wall that is your own mortality, isn't it? People that no one wants getting to the end of the rabbit hole, basically, either way.
Exactly.
Just to say, Pope, I mean, I know you, and a lot of people know you in comedy. I'm sure Dane will testify. Everyone's as fucking proud and pleased for you as possible with this book, mate.
Absolutely, yeah. Ecstatic for you, man.
That's so fucking kind. Honestly, that's mate, it made me well up. That's really kind of you. Thank you so much.
We all know your story. We all know your story. So
and that's what I'm saying. Look, and you, when we talk about it, the emotion that is that it conjures, because you remember where you were then and where you were now, and come a long way, man. We love to see it, Pope, genuinely, man. Yeah. And
come back on the show again. Yeah, clearly, come back. We've barely done the show, so we need to do it again. But thanks, mate. It's been great.
It's been amazing.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, guys. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk. Or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DanesnapTeast. Our guest was Pope Lonergan. You can follow Pope on Twitter at Pope Lonergan or on Instagram at Plug Pope. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at The Howard Cohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at We Are Audio Culture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.